Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, everyone. I'm Richie Cunningham, coming to you tonight from the banks of the River Mersey. In Glasgow tonight is my wife, Oprah.
Hello.
And in Falkirk, my friend, Malcolm.
Hello.
You're not really Richie Cunningham, Oprah and Malcolm. I'm Craig Eastman, and tonight I'm here with OneLiner.com, overlord and guru type person Scott Morris in Glasgow.
Hello.
And of course, not Malcolm, but rather Drew in Falkirk.
Hello.
Tonight, now that I've gotten that out of my system, we're going to be having a little chat about, amongst other things, Planet Terror, Control, The Counterfeiters, Death at a Funeral, Into the Wild, and 30 Days of Night. Of which about three are any good. And the rest we'll be laying into with their own particular brand of barbed invective. Without further ado, we're going to kick off by talking about the first of those, Planet Terror. Scott, fill the listeners in on what it's all about.
Well, Planet Terror, of course, is Robert Rodriguez's entry into the little grindhouse series that Quentin Tarantino started up with Death Proof. It's essentially a tale of a stripper, Rose McGowan, who turns into a mutant zombie killer, as well, aided by El Rey, Freddie Rodriguez, as a kind of generic bad boy outsider type, taking on the forces of evil zombies as Bruce Willis's special forces team somehow releases some sort of gas which turns people into zombies for some reason that's not particularly well explained, because, well, it's not really necessary to explain it for the purposes of the film. Essentially, it's a generic splatter film which survives its extension into a full feature, probably a little better than Death Proof does, but it's still not all that much cop.
Drew, what were your feelings on Planet Terror?
I was just bored by the whole experience. I mean, I appreciated the fact that quite a lot of care and effort had gone into making it look believably like a film shown in a drive-in in the 1970s. I just kind of couldn't decide what the point of that was. The films weren't any good then. Why spend a lot of time and money now making a film look as bad as that did?
I almost think that it didn't do that. I mean, Death Proof was very efficiently capturing the sort of 70s ethos. This really felt more like an 80s film.
Yes, exactly.
Thus making it not grindhouse at all by any sort of standard definition.
Yes.
I was wondering what
exactly.
The point
it was more of a sort of trauma kind of film, wasn't
exactly.
It?
Exactly. Trauma was very much what it was like. But again, it was more. I could appreciate the care that went into it. I couldn't see the point of it. The point of all, let's make this film look really bad, but the original bad films weren't worth watching because they were bad.
Yeah.
Essentially, it feels like it's been a couple of bored filmmakers just toying about, hasn't it?
It just seems incredibly self-indulgent. Mm-hmm. Okay, they grew up with those films, they really liked them. Was there really any need for them to spend a lot of other people's money making them?
I mean, Scott, you said yourself it works more admirably than Death Proof, and I would agree wholeheartedly, but I thought it was a lot more fun. At least it had the good grace to be fun, if nothing else, and in that respect I enjoyed it a lot more than I enjoyed Death Proof. I mean, I still wouldn't class it as a worthwhile experience necessarily, but at least it gave me sort of 90 minutes of entertainment, which Death Proof most certainly didn't. I think Robert Rodriguez appreciates more the fact that, do you know what, there really is no content to any of this experience other than the sort of aesthetic of it, so I might at least just give people a lot of heads exploding for their money.
Yeah, I think it had a far better structure than Death Proof did. I did think it bombed along quite nicely, and I didn't feel particularly bored at any point of it, which is always a good thing.
No, it nipped along at a fair old lick, is it not closer to an hour and 40 or something like that, if I remember
the
correctly?
The international version, which is the one I saw, it's the same as the unrated DVD version, is 105 minutes, and I felt most of them.
Did you? See, I thought it was far less noticeable than Death Proof. Death Proof, to me, I would probably sooner have set fire to my face than watch Death Proof again. There's no point to it whatsoever at all, and it wasn't fun. There's no point to Planet Terror, but at least I thought it was quite fun.
Yeah, but what I liked about this is you really couldn't find any points where they've obviously just inserted content to make the film longer, where it's quite painfully obvious in Death Proof when you're sitting there going, okay. This bit belonged to cutting. This is the pacing reasons people were talking about.
Well, there's an easy way to spot that in Death Proof. The bits they've inserted, they haven't bothered to actually apply the film process to make it look like old film. Yeah. So it jars suddenly from looking as if it's been intentionally made to look like an old film to actually all of a sudden being shot on modern film stock, which kind of takes the edge off it a little bit, I thought. You know, I'm sure probably it costs about 10 pence to put it through some sort of... I'm sure Adobe After Effects will do that for you in about 10 minutes flat, you know, for however much a copy of that sort of thing costs these days. So why they couldn't be bothered doing that? It really is just... It just highlights how cynical a ploy it was on the part of the Weinsteins to get more money from you. You know, just increase the profit margin by that extra $10 or whatever it would have cost them to apply it to those extra segments. But I thought Planet Terror, I mean... Had I paid £7 to go and see Planet Terror, I'm not sure whether I would have enjoyed it so much. But actually just, you know, being able to watch it and sit down and just enjoy it for what it is, I thought it wasn't terrible. Well, it was intentionally terrible and it succeeded well in sort of entertaining me. I mean, I'm not going to buy it when it comes out on DVD or anything, but I wouldn't say to someone, don't watch it, it's terrible.
I think the worst thing about this film was just the sense of wasted opportunity. I mean, if it had come out as the proper Grindhouse thing, I think it would have really worked very well.
It's
just such a shame that it kind of grew legs and come to this monstrous eventual budget that demanded that they try and make the money back, and it's just not worked.
Yeah, as a concept, it was interesting at least. And the two films together, as a concept, that's interesting. I'm still not, wouldn't have liked it much, I suspect, but that was interesting, that was different, and I appreciate that nowadays.
You could at least have argued the case for it being cinema as experience rather than cinema as craft.
Possibly so, yeah.
But I think can we all agree though that for listeners out there who may not be aware or you know have not much concept of these, can we at least agree that it's at least worth popping into the cinema for the first 10 minutes just to catch the machete trailer?
The machete trailer is the best part.
Yeah, it's definitely a highlight.
Danny Trejo and Machete. I want to see that film now.
Well, hopefully, I mean, rumours abound that it is actually going to go into production, but. I don't know whether to take that with a pinch of salt or not.
Well, I suspect they might have done had the Grindhouse concept made any real money, but it didn't.
Yeah,
so
it
I
didn't
suspect
particularly
they
did it. So, but there's surely money to be made in the DVD market, isn't there?
Well, yeah, I mean that's what we mentioned before. The initial concept seems to have been this would come out in the cinema if it started up again in the range of Grindhouse presents DVDs. You know, you give either an up and coming director or someone who's just between projects, give them $1 million, go off and shoot something silly and release it on DVD, and it'll almost certainly make its money back. And that seemed to be a good way to run a series, but instead, with the kind of colossal albatross that this one's turned into, that's never going to happen. And I think that's a bit of a shame.
That is a bit of a shame. So would you recommend then, guys, just to wrap up Planet Terror, you know, if you're kicking about, you've got nothing better to do, you've got £7 in your pocket, would you recommend someone go and see it? Drew?
No, absolutely
Scott?
Not.
Well, I think purely on the basis that the way the human people were ripped apart didn't seem particularly realistic. I'm just going to get a thumbs down for me.
There you go. That's our verdict on Planet Terror. Moving on now, we're going to speak a little bit about Control. Drew, fill us in on Control.
Control is a biopic from Dutch first-time feature director Anton Corbijn about the lead singer and lyricist of the band Joy Division, Ian Curtis. The film covers the formation of the band in late 70s Macclesfield under the name Warsaw, through their change to Joy Division, signed to Factory Records, and ending with Ian Curtis's death in 1980.
I think the problem that Control has is that it's not the most interesting story in the world, and Ian Curtis, well, it's obviously very sad he killed himself at 23, it's not the most tragic or compelling story in the world. Essentially, for a man who's has a few fairly, well, relatively minor problems. He has some trouble with his wife, played by Samantha Thornton, and his mistress, Alexandra Maria Lara. The basic reasons he wound up killing himself seemed to be more of a bad reaction to the anti-epilepsy drugs that he was put on, which did appear to be prescribed to him more or less at random. And Here's a handful of drugs, and if any of these work, then that's a bonus. If not, come back.
Well, someone has to be the first monkey shot into space, don't they?
Yeah, I don't know if that's the way that epilepsy is treated these days, Drew, but it seemed a bit unusual to me.
It's certainly not, and I very much suspect it wasn't how it was treated then, but it's how it came across in the films largely. Here's a handful of pills, take some. If you feel better, take some more. If you feel worse, stop taking them.
Unless you're already dead.
Yes, come back if you feel like it. Yes, but mostly it did seem to cover something of his relationship with Samantha Morton, playing his wife, Deborah Curtis. A lot of the problems there, probably because they married so young. There was a little bit of his relationship with their manager, Rob Gretton, and it spends a fair bit of time on his infidelity on his wife with Annick Honoré, the French or Belgian journalist. But yeah, there's not a lot happens. It's a very pretty film, but not a lot happens, and it didn't tell you too much about the man. He had a very great problem with epilepsy. That's probably deeply unpleasant. It gave him a lot of medical problems, caused him to kill himself because he couldn't take feeling so unwell. But there's not really a lot more to it than that.
It's not a terrible film. It's a lot more compelling than I'd probably have expected for someone whose previous claim to fame filmatically would be doing Depeche Mode videos.
Yes.
I mean, his bread and butter still seems to be still photography, and that kind of shows through in the production values here.
The cinematography is quite, as far as black and white cinematography goes, it's quite lush, really, isn't it?
It's absolutely remarkable. The use of contrast in it is fantastic, and there's parts of it where Macclesfield looks like Mordor. It's just an astonishing work of just visually, it's astonishing.
Yeah, it's an absolute.
Well, if anyone should know how to meet a film camera, it's got to be this guy.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful to look at. And another reviewer that I'd read or heard had said that pretty much every single shot in the film is composed in a way that you can imagine it being a poster on somebody's wall, and that was in fact spot on. About 95% of the film, any frame you look at, you think, yeah, that could be a photograph or a poster that somebody would display. It's beautiful, and it's not saying that there's no substance to the film. There's just, you wish there was a bit more, because it isn't the most compelling story. But
I always think that in all but the most remarkable of historical figures' cases anyway, that biopics really pretty much, you know, live or die by things like cinematography and performance, because I think it's very difficult for a biopic to have any kind of substance to it. Essentially, they're all the same, and that, yep, you know what, it's a story of one person's battle against yada, 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 X, Y, Z.
Yes.
And for me, I struggle to engage with most biopics, and it is a case of, does it have great performances? Does it have lovely cinematography? And these are the things which, for me, a biopic will live or die by. I mean, does it scores highly on those counts then, I guess. Given that, am I going to want to go and see it?
I would say so. I mean, obviously being a fan of the Joy Division would help. Certainly if you have any interest at all in their music or their lives, it's definitely worth seeing. Even if you don't, it's worth seeing just because it is so pretty, and you really need to see this kind of thing just to show you what can be done with a cinema palette.
Yeah, it's one of those films you can go and just for the technique of it and the art of it rather than the content even, you could just sit there and enjoy it because it looks so damn nice.
But given that it's drawn so much praise from the cinema press then, and a lot of people have spoken about it in awards terms and things, you guys feel there's actually a sort of suspicious lack of substance there then?
Not so much that. I mean, it's limited by its subject matter. For me, if there's anything more limiting it, it was really more the fact that Curtis is kind of withdrawn, is perhaps not the right word, but he's not the most outgoing, he's not the most outspoken, he's not espousing any particular philosophies to any great extent. He's just up there singing, and basically once he's on stage, he actually comes alive. You see him starting to get the energy behind him and sort of flowing a bit more, but when he gets off stage, he's very very much a kind of silent kind of character, which is obviously difficult to put in a film.
Yeah, he's not exactly introverted, he's just a quiet person.
Yeah.
Not in any way exuberant, he's quiet, gets on with his life, he sits and writes lyrics, then enjoys performing them, but he's not a remarkable person from that point of view.
Yeah, I mean it's quite obvious when you've got guys like Tony Wilson and Peter Hook around him who get all the best lines and pretty much supply all the high points of the film, and it's left to Ian Curtis as kind of more the straight man to their act, and that kind of drags it down a little bit, I think.
Even in one of the best lines also, even their manager Rob Gretton gets... there's not really much dialogue, great dialogue that Ian Curtis gets. So I would imagine he left most of his great writing to his lyrics rather than anything he said to people in real life.
Yeah.
So not really one that we should probably expect to, well, certainly sounds worthy enough, but not necessarily one that we should expect to see much of on the awards stage, perhaps other than for performance issues. But is our man Anton Corbijn one to watch for the future then?
I would say so. It'd be interesting to see what he does when he gets something a little more meaty behind him.
Yeah, certainly the way he shot the film is very promising. Again, you can't really decide what he would do with some with other films simply because there wasn't a lot of meat in this. Mm. But visually, he's got the credits.
Well, one possibly for the Joy Division fans then, or at least the ones who haven't probably hung themselves or OD'd yet. We'll speak next about the Counterfeiters. Scott, what's that all about then?
Well, barring a few name changes, it's more or less a true story based in during the Second World War in the concentration camps, where a group of Jewish prisoners are rounded up to take part in a secret counterfeiter project, where basically the Nazis were trying to flood the market with fake pounds and dollars to firstly destroy the enemy's economy and then secondly to actually fund their war effort as things tailed off towards the latter end of the 45-year. Salomon Soromich, who is regarded as the king of counterfeiters, is eventually arrested and put into the concentration camps, where he manages to survive with his artistic talent, getting some privileges from various camp commandants. He's transferred to this counterfeiting project, and while he's basically trying to keep his head down and survive, some of the other prisoners there, including a guy called Adolf Berger, played by August Steele, who's quite a big deal in Germany, I believe, is preaching resistance through sabotaging the project, which of course helps the war effort somewhat indirectly. It's a rather interesting film. It has some very compelling performances, and it's quite enjoyable, I thought.
Yes, it's a very good film indeed. Particularly August Steele and Karl Markovic, who plays Sorovich, are particularly good performances. It's also, it's very thought-provoking, because it's not just a typical case of, we know we're going to die anyway, why should we help the Germans, when all the main character particularly is thinking, my life's gotten a bit better than it's been. If I please these people, I stay alive longer. You've got to think, try and put yourself in that position, incredibly difficult, but decide, what would you do there? Yes, they know that the Germans are killing Jews, and some of the people in the group have been taken out of Auschwitz, so they knew exactly what was going on, but things have been better for them. And their life gets immediately worse if they sabotage it, but possibly by helping, it means the Germans would win the war and every Jew would die.
That's why I call it a big-ass dilemma.
I sort of mentioned that, actually. I don't think I made it quite clear, but the group of counterfeiters are being kept in a slightly better conditions than the rest of it. They're getting certain perks. They're well-fed there, and I think what the actual real-life people called it, the golden cage. So it's a little better than being in a standard concentration camp, although you could argue that's still not very good.
Yeah. I'd imagine there's an aspect of the Stockholm syndrome there too, that they've been treated better by their captors, so they might feel some sort of bond towards them. Difficult as that might be to imagine, given what had been done by the Nazis, but they've got to weigh up whether helping themselves is more important to them than, in the end, helping other people.
I'm quite interested by the counterfeiters, actually. I'm correct in saying it's a German production, largely.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, and up until recently, a German film hasn't necessarily been the most accessible. But now that it's on the world stage, I mean, recently we've had films like The Lives of Others, which is an absolutely excellent piece of filmmaking. And obviously, just a couple of years ago, we had Der Untergang, Downfall, as some listeners are more likely to know it. I mean, is this Germany now sort of having found its feet on a world cinematic stage, finally able to sort of come to terms with its own past and some of its own atrocities through its filmmaking? Or have I just not seen a lot of German cinema before this?
It's always hard to say. I mean, you always get the best of German films shown in this country because they're not going to bother importing the crappy ones. So there's possibly an element of that.
There's an element of that, but there also is the fact that Germans are beginning to make films about their history, something they've been understandably very sensitive about in the past. And it's not just a case of this sort of film making it here. It is the case that they're tackling subjects they would been loath to do in the past. To their credit, they're doing it very, very well.
Well, it certainly seems so. One to investigate then. Of the films I've spoken of so far, I detect the most positive reaction from you boys.
Oh yes, I mean, certainly a lot of compelling performances. It's very entertaining. It's definitely one of the year's better films. I can't, off the top of my head, think of anything better than it that I've seen this year. So,
how wide a release has it received, though? I mean, is the average Joe listening to this podcast going to be able to saunter on down to the multiplex and catch it?
If they have a time machine and can go back a couple of weeks, they probably would have been able to. It got a reasonably wide release for this sort of thing, but I believe it's pretty much gone now. So you're onto the DVD market, I would think, in a few months.
Well, no doubt it might actually sit more comfortably for a lot of viewers anyway, given that sort of the weighty subject matter and the fact it's got foreign words in it and that. We're going to speak next about Death at a Funeral, which, again, I haven't seen myself personally, but having spoken briefly to the lads before the show, I'm not getting good vibes about it. Drew, Death at a Funeral, interesting name for a comedy.
It would be if it were a comedy. It's not a comedy. It's quite an appropriate name. It's your death in a cinema.
So it aims to be a comedy, but actually it's more of a travesty then.
It is hands down the least funny thing I have seen in years.
That bad?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what's the general plot?
It's just, it's terrible. It's just, everything is so badly telegraphed. There's Matthew McFadyen, who plays the main character, Daniel. His father has died. So the whole family and all friends, etc., are getting together for the funeral, as you do. But on the way, people do things like, oh, look, the nephew here has got some drugs lying about and puts them in a Valium bottle. Somebody comes in feeling really upset. Oh, no, what could possibly happen?
I know. Let's pick up some random drugs that are just lying about and take them, because that's what any sane person would do.
So actually, it's a drug slapstick film, then.
Well, this basically means you've got Alan Tudyk wandering about going, ooh, look at everything green, then stripping naked and running about a lot in the way that's it's all very irritating, a kind of screwball comedy sort of thing, but it's just insufferable. There's Peter Dinklage threatening to reveal the sordid details of his relationship with Daniel's father and all sorts of nonsense occurring that just really should not have been made in the first place.
Still, even after the first 3 minute long black and white animated title sequence, and by the end of that you're bored to tears. It's terrible. Everything about it is terrible, including particularly the only thing that even comes close to being funny because it's so bad is Ewan Bremner's accent.
Oh Jesus.
Oh God, Ewan Bremner. When will he learn?
It's terrible. Wait, you remember his strange Irish accent in Welcome to the Jungle?
Yes, Irish by way of, well, I don't know, Swahili, I think.
Yeah, well, that accent was about 10 times better than his accent in this.
Why is it then that filmmakers insist on hiring Ewan Bremner for roles where he's required to wear an accent?
I know, there was no requirement for him to do that, as far as I can see, certainly in terms of the character. It was completely irrelevant, especially because he's in it so seldom.
The character himself was entirely irrelevant. No real purpose to anything. It's just, if you are going to do this sort of ensemble piece, then you might actually want to look at getting a cast that's any good whatsoever at comedy. And this is just it's full of Britain's sub-Z-list comedy stars. I mean, as a general rule of thumb, if you have Andy Nyman in a film, it's not going to be funny because the man is the least funny person on earth. He's worse than Jimmy Carr.
The whole thing, it's just so terrible. And examples of Andy Nyman and Ewan Bremner are going to the film, and Andy Nyman suggests that, what is it about funerals? Oh, wait, yes, funerals are so depressing. Ha ha ha, that's so witty. And then it's like, unsuspectingly taking some drugs. Oh ho, it's so funny. And then as a foul-mouthed old man. Oh ho ho, oh ho, it's so funny. It's just a nasty, nasty, terrible, terrible, terrible film without any laughs whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, we used to have a general rule of thumb around here where Sweet Home Alabama is generally considered the least funny film that we can imagine in any given instance. This manages to be quite substantially worse than it. Ooh. I did not. I mean, it's no exaggeration. I mean, it's quite easy to make me laugh. I have a very low standard, so I actually watched the Good Luck Chuck and quite liked it. But I sat through this and did not even smile once. It's a dismal, pestilent nonsense, and I have actually been to funnier real funerals in my life.
So, is this then, do we have a new benchmark here, lads? Is Death at a Funeral to comedy what Full Frontal is to meaningful drama?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's not one redeeming feature about that film.
Listeners, we don't like to come across a benchmark here of that kind of calibre, but it appears we have. You now have Full Frontal, Baise-moi, and Death at a Funeral as your unholy trinity. You may hear us referring to other films in these terms from now on. Be yes. warned.
I mean, honestly, I expect far better from this director, Yoda.
You'd think Yoda would be able to pop together a decent ensemble comedy, yeah?
Yeah, bad show, Frank Oz, bad show. I'd stand by the fact that putting jokes in a comedy would be a good idea, though.
Yes.
It might be a starting point.
It's a million to one chance, but it might just work.
Next on our agenda tonight, an earnest film by one of the most earnest men on the planet, Scott, fill us in on the details of Sean Penn's directorial meanderings of Into the Wild.
There's not an awful lot of details to provide in this sort of thing. A young boy, I think he ends up being about 23-year-olds at the time this is going off, Christopher McCandless, just finishes college and decides that rather than do the what his parents want him to do and go on to law school, he's going to give all his money to charity and go off and find himself and go on a bit of a cross-country tour across America and have various little adventures and eventually try and find his way up to Alaska, where he'll hopefully start communing with nature and all that sort of hippie nonsense. It's quite a visually pretty film, but in terms of actually providing any sort of reason to care about what Christopher's actually doing, not so much.
Drew, did you watch Into the Wild?
I did, and for reasons I can't explain, for the first 90 minutes I was quite enjoying it, although for no reason, really, as I say, no reason I could work out. But then after that, the next, well, almost an hour after that, began to really, really drag. It's okay, it's quite nice looking. It's just that the story that it tells has got no place on film, because there's certainly nothing that happens that's interesting enough to have warranted being made into a motion picture.
Yeah, I sat through all of this waiting for someone to provide a reason for me to actually care about this guy. It's always hinted at, and he keeps giving you little bits about, oh, yes, and there was this trouble with his parents, and then going off and doing something else for a while and kind of referring back to it, but never actually telling you anything. And by the time you get what seems to be the full story, his reasons for being upset with his parents are actually pretty slim. And you just get the impression that this is a guy, I mean, fair enough, if you want to go and do this kind of thing and have a little adventure while you're still young, I've no great complaints with that, but don't try and pretend that you're some sort of new age hippie and sort of saving the world from capitalism and that sort of thing, which seems to be what it's almost implying at certain points. It also managed to annoy me within about the first half hour, I believe. I think it's about 10 minutes in where his sister is providing narration, and she says that he was off to try and find the truth of his own existence. At which point I sort of settled back and thinking, okay, this is going to be fairly pretentious.
Did you drown in the pretentiousness of that, did you?
Yeah, and then it was not long after that, he's, for some reason, eating an apple while talking to the apple, telling it how fantastically wonderful it is, and then for no good reason, he just stops and mugs at the camera for a little while.
Yeah, that
and then
really goes bothered me. And breaks the fourth wall for no good reason.
Exactly. It made no sense to have that there. In fact, the whole scene made no sense, because even the way it's cut, it was quite obviously cut, another take, and then cut, and another take. And it just didn't seem to... I just don't know what that was doing in the film at that point. It made no sense.
Did he bump into Timothy Treadwell at any point?
He didn't, and there was no talking about bees, although he did meet a bear at the end of it.
Did he? Is that the end for him?
Sadly, no. It's a golden opportunity wasted, I thought.
It's unaccountably got Sean Penn goes to the bother of getting a bear in and doesn't have him eat his face off. It's most disappointing.
Sean. When will he learn? What a schoolboy error.
There were a few other points, like the apple section, that just utterly inexplicable scene, particularly in slow motion of him in sparkling sunlight washing from a makeshift shower. It looks like it should be in a Timothy advert. It's got no place in that film whatsoever, and it's utterly pointless. And just the whole film is vaguely pointless. Yeah. A film like that, when a man's going out, he's going through the wilderness, it's only on a journey to find himself. The point really is very much the journey rather than the destination, but neither seem to have any purpose in this film at all. The character doesn't change. He changes a couple of people he meets. He makes them happier and starts preaching to them about his philosophies, but the character is largely the same beginning to end. Like, this is what I'm going to do, and he does it, but it does not make for interesting viewing.
Of course, it should be pointed out the reason we're making this film was that he did actually do what he set out to do by getting to Alaska and then couldn't tack it and died. Which isn't much of an achievement, really. It's not what I'd want to be remembered by.
He just goes along his journey, he goes out to do what he wanted, and he has some fun, and he meets some nice people, and they're like, yeah, that's all very well. I'm not getting anything from this film, though. So he's not learning anything.
Especially by the end of it, I actually got more pissed off with him as time went on, because it did seem that his reasons for walking out on his mother, father and sister and causing them endless heartache was slender to the point of non-existence, and you could really be handled with, you know, one sit down and talk with his dad. Apparently his dad didn't tell him something about a previous marriage.
That really, really bothered me, how he treated his family, because in the beginning the poem. He reads a poem to his sister, which suggests that something quite sinister had happened to him and his sister.
Yeah.
She's just been abused, but you later find out that's a nonsense. It's like their parents shouted a bit, and his father was a bigamist, but they seem to be quite well provided for and quite well loved as children. Perhaps he didn't get along with his parents, okay, but there's no reason to put them to anguish by disappearing and dying.
I mean, I believe the phrase is just cowboy up, get over it. But yes. No, it's America, can't do that.
Another reason you particularly dislike the character is the way he treats his sister. He spends so much of the start of the film saying things like, clearly has a very healthy relationship with his sister, they're good friends, and he says that she's the only person, obviously, who could really understand how he feels, having both had the same upbringing, but then dumps her as badly as he dumps his parents and never speaks to her again. Never bothers to think, yes, I was friends with her, we had the same problems, perhaps I'll drop her a postcard saying, hello, I'm not dead yet, but doesn't. Because he's a prat.
Sean got a bear in, but it's a nice bear, so don't worry.
Yeah, it's not one of those vicious attack bears, sadly.
Who is this film marketed at then?
Sean Penn fans.
Pretentious art house types, in the main.
So not one that we're particularly going to recommend then.
It wasn't a terrible film, if I'm being brutally honest. You could sit there and watch it, and it is expansive enough in its views and nature to warrant it being at least slightly interesting at about 2 hours and 20 minutes. It's way too long.
It's at least it's a good hour too long.
Yeah.
It's, for the first 90 minutes, I was quite enjoying it. Not for no reason I could particularly put into words and say to somebody, oh, this thing's good or this thing's good, go and see it. But I found myself enjoying it. But after an hour and a half, it's like, is it over yet? Please be over. And it carries on.
Did you enjoy it enough to the extent where you would agree with the current IMDb user rating of 8.3 out of 10?
I have certainly no clue where that comes from. To be honest, all the reasons I like this film could be adequately done by just going out and buying the Planet Earth DVD instead, which would be a lot better.
And have David Attenborough, which is considerably better.
Yeah, so that's,
and sharks.
That's my recommendation. Planet Earth instead of this film.
Sharks. If your bag isn't particularly people giving away a lot of money and wandering into the Alaskan wilderness to befriend apples, then you might instead want to check out one of the most entertaining films, certainly, I've seen in recent times, and that would be 30 Days of Night. 30 Days of Night is the latest effort from director David Slade, who most recently brought us the uncomfortable but very compelling Hard Candy. In this film, Josh Hartnett is one of a number of people living in a small Alaskan town, which every year is cut off from, well, inexplicably really, cut off from civilization by 30 nights and days of continuous darkness as the sun disappears underneath the horizon. Unfortunately for the residents of this town this year, some hideous vampires decide to drop in and spoil the party as they are wont to do. It's not up there with The Lost Boys, but I have to say I enjoyed this incredibly. Guys, what did you think?
It's quite easily the best horror film that I've seen in a good long while, mainly because it eschews most of the kind of horror standards and doesn't really feel an awful lot like a horror. It's more like a kind of a tense piece like Assault on Precinct 13 or The Thing, where they're a band of survivors sort of banding together rather than trying to fade their way through some arbitrary nonsense.
It's kind of Rio Bravo meets The Lost Boys, isn't it?
Yeah.
Assault on Precinct 13 is quite a good analogy, actually. It's very like that, with people trying to get in from the outside. The fact they're vampire-like creatures is rather irrelevant, actually, which is perhaps one of the reasons it works better.
Well, I've got to tell you that it's been a long time since I've actually seen a horror film with quite such an unsettling atmosphere to it. David Slade certainly makes the most of the darkness. It's not something which is an easy feat to pull off, a film which is which contains about maybe 2 minutes of daylight, if you're lucky, and the rest of which is shot entirely at night. It's not an easy feat to accomplish, a sort of a good-looking film, but as far as a film shot in those conditions can be good-looking, I think this is certainly very atmospheric. And also, I was quite pleased by the vampires in this one. Don't really conform to any sort of vampire conventions, really, do they? The cinematic form of the vampire is either, you know, the sort of, you have the Len Wiseman version, which is all sort of very incredibly good-looking goth, sort of, you know, the way every fat goth would like to think they look. Mm-hmm. Or you have the Bram Stoker variant, don't you? Or, of course, you've got the Lost Boys, who are a bit sort of, you know, slick and sexy and very sort of punk and sort of thing. Whereas here, these are just nasty people, aren't they?
They are. They're suitably evil. They look like proper evil animals. They're not these beautifully thin goth stereotypes. They are just nasty, evil, ripping people apart, blood everywhere, evil people.
Yes, clearly they're not just humans with some pointy incisors. They're humanoid, but clearly not human, and have teeth like SRAM from Terrorhawks.
That's it. Oh, do you know what? That is really unsettling. The sort of upturned nose kind of toothy sneer thing that's going on, and the shriek as well, the sort of vampire shriek they have.
The sound design in the film is very good, and the shriek. It's deeply unsettling, especially through a cinema sound system. I'm not sure that's going to work quite as well in a home environment, but through the incredibly loud speakers you get in the cinema, just the shriek of the vampires, it's like fingernails down a blackboard. It just puts you on edge so much.
The best sound design I've seen in a film since... Well, certainly for bad guys since War of the Worlds, with the excellent kind of foghorn noises that the alien stalkers do. It's all that kind of oh crikey feeling of the sort of shuffling uncomfortably in your seat. It was a lovely noise.
Yeah. I would have to say that by the end of the film, I was tiring of it a little. I was thinking, okay, stop shrieking now, please try something else. But it's a deeply, deeply unsettling sound. As soon as you hear it, it's like, I want it to stop. And it makes for uncomfortable viewing, but of course that's rather the point of the film.
I'm a little bit frustrated by 30 Days of Night because it's clearly has a lot of potential in it, yet I feel that it fails to meet a lot of it. It's got all the right ingredients that it needs. It's very atmospheric, it's very unsettling, which is not a word I will use very often about modern horror films. Modern horror has completely forgotten how to be unsettling, and that is the essence of what is actually horror. It's not people having their heads ripped off, although there is an incredible amount of that in here. There's a lot of blood and a lot of gore in this film, and I was actually quite surprised at how much of that they got away with for a 15-rated film. It seems that if you have a sort of a fantasy or horror element to it these days, you can get away with pretty much anything with a 15 certificate in UK cinemas. But all the ingredients are there, and yet I feel for some reason it fell just short of reaching its potential. But I've got to tell you, I enjoyed it a lot more than any other horror film I've seen recently, apart from maybe Bug, which I got round to watching just the other day there as well. This is actually, whereas Bug has pretenses of being something a bit more meaningful, this, as far as multiplex sort of mass market horror fare goes, is very accomplished and probably the best thing I've seen in a long time. I just can't help but feel that it's just missing a little something though.
What I liked about this, I agree, it was probably that I missed something that just pushed it over the top, but it did some excellent work all the way through. It did a great job of just ratcheting up the tension slowly and slowly, and I thought it was quite clever that in pan with that, it was more or less ratcheting up the gore as time went on as well. At the start of it, you see, okay, a lot of people get killed, but you don't really see a lot of graphic detail going on. It's only when you get towards the end of the film where you start really seeing some actually horrific stuff, and I have to give a huge plaudits to the... Yeah. The effects work, especially the last couple of people you see dying, is really remarkable, and it's some of the most realistic looking rent asunder bodies that I've seen in cinema in a good long while. A very impressive outing for all concerned, I thought.
It certainly does deliver. I mean, for people, a lot of people are probably going to go to see it in the hope that it's going to give you some sort of, you know, Saw-like levels of gore. And to be honest, it does. It succeeds admirably on that level alone. And as you say, it's not just a relentless assault from the get-go, but it does. 30 Days of Night builds up gore in the way that most thrillers would like to, you know, imagine they could build up tension. It does sort of, like you say, just... It ekes out bit by bit until, you know, you start off with people just being dragged off into the darkness and sort of very, you know, indeterminately being sort of obviously dispatched with, but not in a very visual way. And then it ends up with people being put through shredders.
People rather graphically having the heads chopped off. If you like decapitations in a film, again, this is a good one for you. There's quite a few of them throughout this.
Goodness,
it's probably what I look for in a film. Number of heads that hit the floor. Yeah, always a plus point.
Gore really does nothing for me, but decapitations I am a fan of.
Exactly. If you're a fan of seeing people have their heads ripped off, then this is, you know, £7 well spent, certainly. I mean, it doesn't just succeed on that level. I mean, I have to point out that although it will satisfy just gore hounds, it does deliver in a lot of other areas. It doesn't quite you know, it doesn't quite slam dunk, but it's as good as we've seen in a long time. It's not up there with Lost Boys, which had at least an element of humour to it. 30 Days of Night is very much a sincere film. There's not a moment of it where we're not asked to take this seriously. It's not, there's no tongue-in-cheek kind of references there or anything like that. It wants to be a serious horror film, and for the vast majority of its runtime, it certainly succeeds. Yeah, it's also worth pointing out, I think, that 30 Days of Night, I'm quite surprised by the calibre of the performances involved. I mean, would you guys agree that for something of this type, nobody's going to win an Oscar for it, but I was quite pleasantly surprised by the sort of proficiency of the acting involved.
Yeah, I mean, Josh Harness is no fantastic actor, but he's considerably more than adequate. And so it provides a quite likeable lead character. And Danny Houston, who I've been a big fan of really since The Proposition. I wasn't really particularly aware of him before that, but ever since The Proposition, I've wanted to see him in more, and he doesn't have a lot to say, and most of it's screeching, but certainly there's something indefinably menacing about him in this that a lesser actor, I suspect, wouldn't have been able to pull off.
Yeah.
What I think, what was impressive, I thought, for the most part, was, like, as you say, it is a fairly earnest film, and the performances in it are quite earnest, and it's quite hard to judge that level of performance in a, when you've got a subject matter like vampires running about biting people's heads off, to manage to keep that level of earnestness there without it feeling kind of silly or forced. And I think everyone managed that quite well, and I guess that's part of the skill of the director.
Most definitely. I mean, there are a couple of scenes where there's one scene in particular where I cannot remember the character's name. The coloured fellow who's aware of the fact that he's becoming a vampire and basically said, you know, he basically goes outside and allows himself to be dispatched with before he becomes a danger to everybody else. There are actually a couple of moments in this film as well where you do feel a bit of empathy for the characters, and it's I wouldn't go so far as to say it's moving, but it certainly gives a greater level of viewer involvement than you have any right to expect given the current crop of nonsense we have thrown in our face and, you know, told this is horror, accept it.
For essentially a throwaway horror film, I can't remember the last time I've seen characters with such depth to them as you get in this film. It's normally just, you know, generic teen five who will be offed by whoever that current slasher du jour seems to be. And it certainly puts us a level above everything else I've seen this year.
Yeah, and it's a pleasant change too. You for the most part, want the townsfolk to come through. You care about the characters enough that you want them to win, as opposed to pretty much any other horror film in recent years where you're desperate for the bad guys to come and eat their face off or whatever they're going to do in that particular film as soon as possible, just to get these annoying people off of your screen.
I mean, I think I'm correct in saying this film spent at least 1 week at the top of the charts in the States. I mean, it hasn't done fantastic business over here, but I would like to think that this is one of those films that people are going to discover over time on DVD. Like I say, it's not perfect, but it's better than the vast majority of horror fare out there, and it does build up a lot more. It appreciates what it is to build tension and atmosphere.
So it came out within a few weeks. It's tripe, like Resident Evil 3, Black Sheep, and Saw 4. And it's just, it's incomparable, the difference, really.
Mm.
It's just so many levels above that rubbish.
I really do hope that people are going to actually sit down and get this on DVD, and over time, sort of word of mouth is going to spread that, do you know what, this is actually, you're accepting nonsense like House of Wax as being as being horror. It is not horror. Look, here is a proper horror film. It's not perfect, but it is very, very good. Please at least sit and watch this. I cannot beg people enough who may be listening to this podcast, please, if it's not in your cinema by the time you hear this, when it comes out in DVD, don't even rent it. Go ahead, just buy it. You're not going to be disappointed. And, you know, I don't know. I'm just disappointed that we haven't heard more about it in the press, because I feel it deserves a lot more coverage than it's had.
It's certainly a far more worthy candidate than anything else I've seen this year.
Absolutely. Have either of you gentlemen seen Bug yet?
Not yet, no.
Not yet. I would also just off the cuff recommend that you see that as well. I was very, very pleased by Bug.
Oh, I'm very loath to see anything directed by William Friedkin starring Ashley Judd. This doesn't sound like an appealing combination.
Well, obviously William Friedkin's made some excellent films, and William Friedkin's made some absolute crud, but this is most definitely an excellent film, and I wasn't going to pay much attention to it on the basis of the fact it has Ashley Judd in it. But I can tell you actually that it's very much worthwhile the investment. I don't think it's actually been given a general release over here. It came out last year in the States, and if you want, whereas 30 Days of Night is definitely a sort of a gorier end of the scale, Bug has its moments, but it's more a measured sort of observation of paranoia as much as it is a horror film. It is quite genuinely unsettling, and I shan't say too much more about it other than if you get a chance to pick it up on DVD at the same time as you notice 30 Days of Night, rent the two of them out and have a good old evening in, and prepare to sort of not get much sleep because you'll probably be quite scared by the both of them. It doesn't have the greatest rating in the world on IMDb, which fascinates me because I've seen a lot worse films given a lot better ratings, and it is actually a genuinely very good, very unsettling paranoia stroke horror kind of crossover. Very good indeed. Highly recommended. On that note, we've taken up enough of your time, good people. Hopefully you will join us again next week for more random tangential invectives on the nature of modern cinema. And I have been Craig Eastman. Thank you very much. And it's good night also from Scott.
Goodbye.
And of course, from Drew.
Goodbye.
Take care, and we will hear from you and speak to you again soon. Thank you very much. Bye. I like phenylephrine. It's made me quite giggly.